May it please the court, Your Honor, and I should apologize. My partner, Bill Beal, is also here with me today, and I did not introduce him originally. I apologize. This comes before the court on summary judgment entered against my clients, the plaintiffs below, the appellants before this court. There are three of those plaintiffs, Allman, Team, and Renaissance. The case arises out of a transaction by which a piece of equipment was purchased by an entity called Crush, which is not a plaintiff in the case. Crush purchased this equipment in October of 2002 through two payments made, one on October the 8th of 2002, and the purchase balance, the purchase closed, if you will, on October 25th of 2002. Allman, at that time, was not a member, nor shareholder, nor officer, nor director of Crush. What Allman was a documented lender. Allman had made loans and continued to make loans at different points in time, beginning in the summer of 2002, up to including the time of purchase, and in fact, subsequent to the time of purchase. Okay. Mr. Allman's claims are for fraud and negligent misrepresentation against the manufacturer of the equipment, and I'm going to call them manufacturing, Great Plains Manufacturing.
And is he alleging that the misrepresentations were made directly to him as lender, or that he as lender relied on representations made to other parties?
His claim is based on representations made particularly to him by manufacturer on several occasions and in several forms. In the first instance, by promotional materials, video materials that he saw, by discussions and representations he had with manufacturing representatives at the quarry in the summer of 2002.
With knowledge that, with the intent that it would influence his decision to make a loan?
Yes, and in fact, Your Honor, on October the 17th, Mr. Allman went to manufacturing's facilities in Iowa, and with him were individuals that were members and officers of Crush. Mr. Allman was not. That was on October 17th. And there were representations made to him about the equipment, what manufacturing would do, what the equipment would do, and not coincidentally, that very same day, if you look in the record, it's the legal file, page 1646, Allman extended additional credit. And that's not coincidental. He extended that additional credit based on the representations that had been made to him at the meeting on October 17th in Iowa with personnel from manufacturing. Again, it's important. At that point in time, he was neither an officer, a director, a member, or shareholder. Shareholder, they don't actually have those, but in Crush. And Crush was represented by an officer and a member at that meeting on October the 17th. And Mr. Ullman's testimony is the purpose of that meeting was to satisfy him to make the advances, the loans, that Crush then used to purchase the equipment. So it's by virtue of that that Mr. Ullman has standing to assert both the fraud and the negligent misrepresentation claims against manufacturing. Okay? The case law raises issues on whether a shareholder, or let's even assume extend it to a member of an LLC, can bring those types of claims. But again, at the point in time these misrepresentations were made, and prior to there, Mr. Allman had never been a member or an officer.
Now, just to clarify, there's case law that says a creditor of a defrauded party can't rely, has no right of action for fraud, even though the debtor's ability to pay the creditor is impaired. But you're not claiming kind of being a third-party beneficiary. You're claiming direct misrepresentations to Allman.
Exactly. These are not misrepresentations made by Mr. Allman's creditor, which in this instance is Crush. Mm-hmm. These were representations made by manufacturing.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So that's Mr. Allman's standing to assert those claims. Mr. Allman had no contract with manufacturing, nor did he ever have any contract with what I call Vermeer Great Plains, which is manufacturing's distributor. And Vermeer Great Plains actually sold the equipment to Crush. Okay? And the reason that's important is the economic loss doctrine has been discussed in the case in the briefing, has no application to Mr. Allman's claims. Okay? Because he doesn't have any contractual relationship with manufacturing, who he has his claims against for fraud and negligent misrepresentation. And the representations made to him were made specifically in connection with the purchase and use of this piece of equipment.
Now, I mean, if I understand it right, you're asking us to extend Missouri law beyond where it is now, that if there's a factual statement made with knowledge of reliance of a material fact that's false, to that would inure to the benefit of the speaker, that there is a cause, even though there is no contract with the listener or other independent legal relationship between the listener and the speaker.
Yes, I would add, Your Honor, it's made for the specific purpose of inducing, and in fact, did induce.
That would result in a benefit to the speaker. Yeah.
Correct, Your Honor. I don't believe that's an extension of Missouri law, and the only reason I point out the absence of the contractual relationship, I believe, removes any concern about the economic loss doctrine, because that doctrine essentially springs from concern about a party asserting a tort claim, if you will, in the face of a bargain for contract.
Would you take us on through Crush to the facts of ownership of this equipment?
Crush purchases the equipment and a written warranty. Okay. Under the UCC, at the time Crush purchases that, if the warranty is breached, which our contention, and we believe there's sufficient evidence to support it, is that the machine was defective. Okay. Then at that point in time, Crush has a claim. Okay? Crush has a claim for breach of that express warranty in the simplest approach. Okay? We know this. In December, okay, that was in October, in December of 2002, Mr. Allman becomes a member of Crush. And he not only becomes a member, he becomes a 92.5% controlling interest member.
What's the purpose of Crush? I mean, what was Crush in the construction industry? Or were they basically a holder of the property to the benefit of Allman or others?
Well, as initially conceived before Mr. Allman's involvement, Crush was in, I would call it the business of quarrying and related activities in looking for different technologies, if you will, in that industry. That was the purpose of Crush. The December 2002 transaction that resulted in the amended and restated operating agreement for Crush, which showed Mr. Allman as a 92.5% member, resulted from, and it's in the file, Mr. Allman contributing what then was additional equity, a $200,000 capital contribution.
And when you say he's a member?
Pardon me?
When you say he's a member?
Yes, he became a
partner, shareholder. What's a member?
In a limited, well, if it's an LLC, he's a shareholder. If it's you can have members in a limited partnership, for example. But he was what I would call, at that point in December, he was a
Is this an LLC or a partnership or a corporation or what?
It's not a corporation and it's not a partnership, Your Honor. It had members, and I apologize, I don't recall the exact what was on, I believe it was an LLC.
So we don't know what Crush is.
Well, no, we know what it is, and it's in the record. And Crush was an LLC
and
that
there,
had
there
members.
Were two subsequent LLCs. And one of them was formed to take ownership, allegedly to take ownership of the machine. And then there was another one. Crush was dissolved, and the assets of Crush went to the other LLC. So there was Renaissance and Team, and your theory was that one of the two of them received the machine and the rights to the warranty. Is that a correct statement?
Partially, Your Honor. Let me focus, if I might.
You have very little time left, so you might really focus in on the key thing.
Okay. That's essentially correct, Your Honor.
And the Court of Appeals found that you didn't prove which one had ownership, but the question was it enough to prove that one of them had ownership and that that was a disputed fact?
That certainly would justify overturning the summary judgment. And so, one of these plaintiffs has standing to assert these claims, and we believe more than one of them do, and we've set forth in our brief why that is, and there are, at worst, factual disputes on which that standing issue turns, and the Court of Appeals took it upon itself to actually find facts as an appellate court to try to resolve that standing issue.
One of the statutes governing LLCs says that property that is held in the name of an LLC may be transferred by an instrument of transfer executed by an authorized person in the name of the LLC. Does that statute have application to this case?
It may well, Your Honor. I don't think it imposes a requirement.
Because in this case, there were no documents of transfer to either one of the other LLCs. Is that right?
No, there is a document. There are dissolution documents that transfer Crush's assets to Mr. Allman, and there's a document by which Mr. Allman assigns all those liquidation proceeds to Team.
There's nothing showing it the transfer that you said occurred to Renaissance, though.
No, there are. There's a lease, for example, that evidences
The ownership. The lease back. Yeah, there's no actual transfer document. You said you wouldn't lease it back unless you transferred it.
Yeah, there's no. If the court's looking for a bill of sale,
the Court of Appeals seemed to require some sort of formal documentation. Do you think that was correct, or is that not?
I think that's correct. That's what they believe. I think it's an incorrect view of the law.
I know your time's up, but I want to ask. Can I get to what the resolution of this might be? As I understand it, you represent all these entities or former entities or whatever.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is it your position that you believe that the evidence should be submitted to the jury and then the jury decide which entity owned the machinery and has the claim, or is it your theory that the jury should be allowed to make a common award to all of the entities? Or are you saying I don't have to elect yet, you just can't throw me out of court?
I'm definitely saying the latter. Our position is not, Your Honor, that it's a single lump sum award. There are distinct claims for each of these three plaintiffs, and the damages for each of the three are distinct. Now, we believe as a matter of instructions, which will be a matter for the trial court to handle in the first instance, will determine, I guess, the practical concerns of how is this handled. But yes, we believe there are, at worst, factual issues that a fact finder has to resolve to determine who has what claim. And of course, the instructions, for example, let's take a warranty claim, I'll just assume for today that one element is you own the machine. Well, there may be some dispute on who owned the machine at what point in time. So that's going to have to get resolved by the jury when they consider the verdict director for each of the particular plans.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
May it please the court, Perry Brandt on behalf of Premier Manufacturing Company. With me, and you'll hear from him in a moment, is Gary Willenauer, who represents Vermeer Great Plains. I'm going to call myself Vermeer because that's how I think of myself, and I'll call him Great Plains. Following up on the last question, I do not think it's appropriate, and the Court of Appeals found it was not appropriate for a plaintiff to come in with multiple plaintiffs and say, we don't know who owns this claim, we don't know who owns the property, we don't know anything, but jury, please sort out who does and we'll accept that.
And why not?
Because it's a fundamental element of any claim that you show that you have the right to make
but,
that
but
claim.
But there is competing evidence. So somebody owns it, and it's one of those two LLCs. So why can the jury not resolve between two plaintiffs which one, what evidence they believe?
They bear the burden. Each of those plaintiffs independently bears the burden of coming in with some evidence
and
to
get past
summary judgment. Well, I don't think that they have the evidence if we go back and examine the record in the case of anyone.
And your argument could be interpreted to say nobody gets to sue if there's some evidence that they both own it, then neither one is more than 50%, therefore nobody gets to sue.
I think there's a lot to that, and yet in this case...
I'm not suggesting that's the law. I'm suggesting that's the problem. And then if you have two or three people claiming property, then no one gets it?
But it's their burden. And
to present some evidence from which someone can find their
own. I think if we go through the actual record, we're going to see that nobody owns the claim. First, let me address Mr. Ullman. And with all due respect to Mr. May, I think he got his facts about the record wrong. And let me demonstrate it this way. The purchase here and the negotiations for the purchase here from manufacturing through Great Plains were made by Crush. And over here, Crush is, and Mr. May was right, Mr. Ullman was not involved with Crush at the time as a shareholder or an officer or a director. Crush was Jeff Hall and Gary Watts. And Jeff Hall and Gary Watts conducted the negotiations with Vermeer, made the purchase from Vermeer after a two-month inspection of the machine in operation at the quarry. And Gary Watts' testimony in this case was very clear. That machine operated exactly as represented to me on behalf of Crush. Nobody lied to me. Mr. Ullman is over here as a creditor who is deciding whether or not to make a loan to Crush. At page 1414 of the legal file, you will see that Mr. Ullman guaranteed the loans of $600,000 plus to Crush for the purchase of the machine well before any of the meetings Mr. May talked to you about that he had with Vermeer or with Great Plains, well before he reviewed any promotional literature, videos or brochures or anything. Mm-hmm. Page 1414 of the legal file, you will see.
Is it your position that based upon that fact, if it's uncontradicted, that you couldn't have a fraud or misrepresentation claim based upon an act that occurred after the fact? In other words, if you made it without the representations, whether they were false or not, that you would not state a claim for fraud or misrepresentation?
In these circumstances, no, and here's why. Here, when Mr. Ullman is making the decision whether or not to be a lender, we're not having any contact with him at all. He makes the loan at that point. We didn't deal with him in that capacity as a lender at all. By the time he made the loan, then we get to September 30th, which is when the actual sales order is drafted and the warranty agreement is drafted. There's a consummated transaction at that point. And what the case failed to show in the record, what appellants failed to show in the record, was that there was ever any situation where Vermeer or Great Plains made a representation to Mr. Ullman directly for purposes of inducing him or intending to induce him to make a loan.
He just said he made an additional loan in October the day after he went into Iowa and these representations.
There were advances which followed the Iowa visit to prop up Crush as an operating entity. But again, at page 1414 of the legal file, you'll see the $600,000 plus had already gone over to buy the machine.
But what about for the additional monies? He says he loaned additional monies in reliance on that.
Oh, he loaned money to them on an ongoing basis.
Well, you understand my question.
Could the alleged fraud have
induced those additional payments?
I don't believe so because those payments were for the purchase of the machine. The further loans that may have been made to prop up the business or pay for payroll or whatever.
But there's no fact question as to whether there was fraudulent inducement of those loans?
There's no fact question there was any fraudulent inducement of those loans that were made, because the loans that went to buy the machine were all made pre-sale and before there was any dealing with Mr. Ullman directly. And again, I come back to, there's a paucity, a dearth of evidence in the case that either Vermeer or Great Plains ever made a representation to Mr. Ullman to induce him to make a loan. And the key point that's in the record, and I forget the page on this reference, Mr. Ullman, when I asked him in his deposition, why did you make the loan to buy the equipment? He said, and this is a verbatim quote, it was on the recommendation of Jeff Hall. Now, perhaps Jeff Hall was misled. I don't think so, because Mr. Watts is very clear. I wasn't misled. But it's in his deposition, and I think it's an absolute admission, what induced him to make the loans were Mr. Hall, not either of the respondents.
Can you address the issue of, it's your position that there's no showing that there was a transfer of the property to Renaissance. Why then, when Crush was dissolved and all the assets went to Ullman, and then Ullman sent all the assets to Team, didn't the right to sue for this go to Team?
I don't know, and there's no evidence of that. What we do have with regard to Renaissance and Team is the following. We have the appellants saying, we really don't know, so somebody please sort it out. But if you look at Renaissance individually, there's no document through which that...
And does the law require a document?
Yes. There needs to be something.
What are you relying on for that?
There needs to be something that shows...
What case says that, though? I mean, this is not a transfer of title case. It's not a real property case.
And I don't think...
What requires you to have a document?
I don't think there needs to be a bright-line test, so I can't really say there has to be this form of document, but there needs to be something. All there is here is a lease from Renaissance back to Crush, magically showing that Renaissance owns it, but there's no evidence of a transfer.
Would corporate minutes?
No corporate minutes.
Would that have constituted a document to say?
Potentially.
What about
some
tax
evidence?
Returns that show where they depreciated it?
Tax
How about
returns?
A financial statement that
financial
shows
statements?
Isn't there one document that one of those two corporations have it on their balance sheet?
Team has it on their balance sheet.
So why isn't
and
that
basically
enough?
The same as the purchase price. However, that's not enough to get you past their judicial admission that Team doesn't own it, Renaissance owns it. Because they have taken the position consistently that that one document, that lease document, which leases it back to Crush, magically conferred ownership on Renaissance.
I thought Renaissance says that, but at least in the briefs in this court, my understanding is their argument is that they both claim it. Team claims they own it because if it didn't go to Renaissance, then it was still in Crush and they got all Crush's assets.
That's an either or, and I continue to believe.
Yeah, but it is an either or that the jury could believe it was transferred to Renaissance, and if they don't believe that, then it had to be someplace, so it was transferred.
Well, isn't
to
it?
Team.
Isn't
what
it,
is the problem?
Isn't
with
it kind of black letter law that a party can't create its own factual dispute to win a summary judgment motion?
Agreed.
But aren't these separate parties? They're all plaintiffs, but they are separate parties.
Mm-hmm. You've got, in fact, the separateness of them is the arm's length, potentially lease, between Renaissance and Team.
I mean, in effect, you're requiring them to prove their case in order to have standing, and we don't do that.
No, not prove their case, prove that they have a justiciable interest in
so
the
can
case.
You, again,
there
please answer
threshold.
The question I'd asked earlier you didn't get a chance to answer about whether or not, why, assume, forget about the Renaissance part for a minute. Why, when the Crush assets, there is evidence the Crush assets went to Ullman and then Ullman sent them to Team. There's documentation of that. Is that correct?
Well, I hate to layer a whole other issue on top of this, but actually the assets did not go to Mr. Ullman. They went to Mr. Ullman's revocable trust, which is not a party here, and then purportedly to Team. So there's a whole other layer of standing even there when the non-parties in the mix. But I don't believe that's the case. I don't think they can show the transfer documented from Crush through the Ullman Revocable Trust.
How about the
team.
Law that possession shows ownership? Possession creates a presumption of ownership.
I don't think in a commercial case like this where the ownership of a piece of property by itself confers ownership on you is enough. If Mr. Willnauer stole my car this afternoon, wrecked it, and went and made a claim on my insurance policy, I don't think he has a claim.
That's title property. This is not title property.
Some untitled property.
So who owns it? Is your position is who owns it? No one owns it is your position, right?
My position is they have not come forward with sufficient evidence to beat summary judgment that one party does own it.
So do you have a position as to who owns it?
No. We did not. We always said it was up to them to prove ownership, and that they were not able to prove it. So where we go here, I do believe the Court of Appeals, I'm going to turn the floor over to Mr. Willnauer, I do believe the Court of Appeals decision should be affirmed. I know that they focused on this as a subject matter jurisdiction question, which is not how we focused on it. We looked at a summary judgment issue and a failure of proof on an essential claim. But however you dress this up, we believe the Court of Appeals opinion should be affirmed. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Willnauer.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. May it please the Court. Your Honor, if I can address that one issue that was raised about the statute and requirement of documents, actually, and I don't believe that it's been addressed in the briefing, in the operating agreement for Crush Tech, it specifically addressed that it was required if any assets were to be transferred.
That statute's never been interpreted, and it has the language may, so one doesn't know whether it's mandatory or if it just recognizes that is one of the ways it can be.
The operating agreement at Crush Tech requires it, though, that in order to transfer property, that must be signed off, it must be in writing, must be approved.
Well, what happens when the corporation dissolves?
By that time, by the time the purported transfer occurs, then the 1055 was already transferred to Renaissance Leasing.
Well, but you're saying that wasn't a valid transfer, so then it remained with Crush.
No, if in fact, as the plaintiffs, in answer to your Honor's question, who owns the property? The plaintiff's position in this case is Renaissance Leasing owns the property.
Well, Renaissance says it owned the property, and it shows that it had it and leased it back to Crush. And Team says it owned the property because it got Crush's remaining assets.
No, actually, if you look at what their allegations are, is Renaissance Leasing owned the 1055 machine, and then through the master lease agreement, they leased it back to Crush. Mm-hmm. Crush's assets that then purportedly were conveyed to Mocan and then to Ullman's Trust actually would be an ownership interest in a master lease agreement, not in a 1055.
If the transfer to Renaissance was valid.
This is the position that they've taken, is that they say the master lease agreement is the document that shows evidence that Renaissance Leasing owns it because it's proof in the pudding.
So what is the law that requires, what is required to transfer property from an LLC?
Transfer required from the LLC is you got to follow the operating agreement, right. What the requirements
are. And you can draft that to not require documentation. You can draft it to require a bill of sale. You can draft it to a receipt. If you fail to cover it in your operating agreement, then there's a group of statutes that apply.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so here, sir, assuming they did not follow the operating agreement, you're saying it was an invalid transfer?
It could be an invalid transfer. Yes, ma'am.
And then what's the effect of that if that's the case?
Then if that's the case, then it does go back perhaps to Crush, the master lease agreement that purportedly they had doesn't apply.
And right. Crush's lease goes, Crush's assets ended up with Team.
Well, then Crush's assets end up at Ullman's Trust account, who then purportedly, with no document, no record, just him saying that, I think I then transferred that over to Team. But then what we have is
again, this isn't title property. So what's wrong with his testimony that it was transferred?
Because then you've got the other master lease agreement from Renaissance Leasing that shows that they transferred, or that Renaissance Leasing actually leased the machine to Team. So if Team is the owner of the 1055, why are they signing a master lease agreement?
But why aren't all these fact questions? Why are they standing questions?
Because the standing, the plaintiffs have the burden of proof to show who has standing. No,
but again, aren't you requiring them to prove who owns it so that you don't know you have standing until you get to the end of the case?
These are the arguments that are made by the appellants in this case. So ultimately, at the end of the road,
what about the UCC Article 2 express warranty that if Crush takes it with the express warranty, then sells it or it's taken over by a third party, they still get the express warranty?
That is a potential. That's an issue that is actually for manufacturing, not for me, because we offered none.
We're back down, sir.
But here's what I would say, and I understand it's blinking. The plaintiffs in their reply brief cite the case of Carbic as saying that my client could not convey the exclusions of the implied warranties. And as part of that, however, they say Carbic held that. Carbic does not hold that. Carbic, in that case, the distributor had already been dismissed from that case. They cite the treatise of 3 Anderson UCC. We have done our research. There is a case. There is no case in Missouri that holds that under Missouri's UCC, Article 2, 316, that you cannot, as a distributor, convey the manufacturer's warranty as, or the exclusions, the implied warranties as your own. There's a Colorado case, Graham Hydraulic versus Stewart and Steverson Power, 797 Pacific 2nd, 835. That case is on point with this case, where that Colorado court said, considering the pass-through exclusion, a distributor can independently and effectively disclaim any implied warranties when provided to the buyer a copy of the manufacturer's warranty. In this case, you will see in the material that was provided, there are the warranties, and that was contained on legal file 633, and then the sales order, legal file 629. These documents show that the Graham Hydraulic case should govern the transfer.
You're saying automatic.
Go ahead. I was going to say, let me ask you before you sit down. Here's where I'm going to try and frame this question. One of the concerns that the plaintiff is a party of interest is that then defendant can't be forced to defend another lawsuit after they played the first plaintiff to pay somebody else that claims the same interest. Is there anything in the record that shows that there is a party or a potential party other than the plaintiffs in this case that might claim an interest in these machines? As a practical matter, do you have anybody who has an ownership claim for them in this lawsuit?
It's funny you should mention that. I do know of another lawsuit where the former members of Crush are actually suing Mr. Ullman and his trust and his personal representative now, seeking to overturn Mr. Ullman's activities in trying to take control of this case.
My question is there another potential claimant that is not a party plaintiff in this case now?
Who are going to claim they have standing to sue for these damages?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. Thank you.
Your Honors, I think one thing that is helpful analytically is to keep in mind that at the time of the sale to Crush had a cause of action that arose at that point in time. So that cause of action always resided with Crush. So that cause of action went to Team. Now, the warranty and the product for sale transferred to Renaissance. And so Renaissance itself may have other claims that we believe have accrued under that warranty.
Your opponents argue that there is insufficient evidence that the assets of Crush went to Team, that Mr. Ullman's statements under oath that the assets went is not sufficient evidence of transfer of the ownership of the assets of Crush.
Well, I don't believe that's the law. You can have oral testimony.
Do all three of these LLCs have operating agreements, and are all three operating agreements in the record?
I know they all three have operating agreements, and I believe they are, Your Honor. And on that point, it's important to keep in mind, Crush, by virtue of law, was dissolved.
Right.
So there are certain things that necessarily happen, regardless of what the operating agreement may say, upon dissolution. And there was no objection to the dissolution, which again proved Mr. Ullman can own 92.5% of the company.
If the operating agreement required any transfer of property to be in writing, then does that negate your claim that Renaissance gained an interest?
Not if the transfer occurred by virtue of the dissolution. That's by operation
of law,
Your Honor.
No, that's not how you claim Renaissance got the property.
Yeah. Correct, Your Honor.
I'm saying
sorry.
To Renaissance.
Yes, I believe there was documentation. I don't. I know this. The operating agreement doesn't require, for example, a bill of sale or a purchase or sale.
They could have just given it away to Renaissance for nothing, and that would be valid.
Sure, they could have. They could have gifted it. Absolutely.
But did you have any evidence of who depreciated it on their tax returns or?
No, on the depreciation issue, Your Honor.
No evidence of any corporate minutes acknowledging the transfer of it?
No corporate minutes in the record, no, on that issue. There was, however, and it's at the legal file at page 1409, there is express documentation by which Mr. Ullman, on behalf of his trust, transferred to Team all the liquidation proceeds from Crush, which, when you look at the operating agreement for Crush, includes not only hard assets, but any chosen action, any claim, any cause of action that Crush would have. That's how it's defined. That's the liquidation proceeds. Obviously, Crush's claim for breach of the express it didn't go away. It didn't disappear. And when the proceeds were distributed to Mr. Ullman, he then assigned him to Team by virtue of this document. With respect to Mr. Ullman and his fraud, negligence, misrepresentation claims.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.